Okay. Welcome everyone. It's really wonderful to see so many of you here. That's fantastic. We saw. It is a bit surprising. We thought that snow might keep people away, but it seems to have brought you all in. So it's really nice to see everyone. Really nice to see you. Yeah. Hi there. Come in. Come through. Don't know whether there's any more. Is there any spare seats at the back of it? There's a seat there. People will start pointing you to where you need to go. Has everyone got cushions? I think we're at this rate we'll get to the standing room only. Is there any more cushions back there? Okay. So I was asked to talk about love, which is a good subject to talk about, isn't it? So I'm going to talk about love. And what I'm going to do is talk for a bit, about 15 or 20 minutes, depending how I feel. And then there'll be a bit of time to ask questions, which I may or may not answer, depending whether I like them or not. Okay, so I think really the place to start is the place that we all have started. It's not a subject that one can just... I don't want us to jump in and start talking about the rights and wrongs of love and so forth. I want to start with the place that we've started, which is our birth and our life. Really, that's all we have, isn't it? This, our life. And that's what Buddhism is about, is this our life. That's what the Buddha, the figure here on the shrine, is trying to talk about. It's nothing technical, it's nothing to do with Buddhism, it's nothing to do with spirituality or religion. He was trying to talk to you, trying to talk to me, about our life, about my life. Yeah? And when you think of it, it's odd, this life of ours that we've all got. It's actually positively peculiar. We didn't ask for it, and we didn't design it. So, you know, you didn't ask for this particular life, and you didn't design the life you've ended up with. You didn't think, you weren't sort of floating around in space trying to work out what kind of life you'd like, and then sort of choose selective parents, and then a nice childhood, followed by a good education, followed by, you know, a beautiful romance. The life you've got is just the sort of life you were given, which you didn't ask for, you didn't plan. I didn't ask for and didn't plan. And quite often it's not the life we wanted. It's not the life we would have liked to design. Some people feel that very, very strongly. Some people think actually it's fine, but it's not enough. There's something missing about it. It's not sufficient. It's fine, but it's... can't be it. So there we are as human beings, we're in this position of being given a life we didn't ask for, in a shape we didn't plan. Not only that, but we didn't plan the shape, and actually we don't know what the shape of our life is. Some people, I think, never know. Hi there, come in here, just see a second. Some people, I think, never know the shape of their life. We have to divine ourselves, don't we? We have to work ourselves out. We have to find out what kind of creature we are. We have to, and that's a lot to do with what kind of life we have, but it's also to do with things like our genetic inheritance. You probably, some of you at least, have got to the age where you realise all that reacting against your parents was actually just reacting against yourself, that you're actually very like them, and sometimes rather worryingly like them. I noticed I've got exactly the same cough of my father. And the other day I met my brother and I was wearing my coat and my hat. He says, "Oh God, you look just like Dad." It's the same, basically the same coat and the same hat. Slightly more trendy, but it's basically the same. I think, and here I am, I'm 50, 51, I'm wearing my father's coat, you know. What was all that reacting to him about, you know? So you, they think at the moment, the research suggests that half of you is genetic, in a way. Half of your personality is genetic. So, as it were, half of us is somebody else. And that doesn't just mean your parents, but your genetic loading. So, there we go. We've got this life we didn't ask for, we didn't plan. And we don't know what it is. We don't know what sort of cards we've been given genetically, what predisposed dispositions we'll have, both temperamental as well as physical. So, for instance, they think that things like pessimism and optimism are genetically loaded. So if you have pessimistic parents, you're much more likely to be pessimistic yourself. But you don't know that. You don't wake up at five and think, yes, I'm pessimistic, but I'm an extrovert, and I need time alone to do creative work. You know, it takes you about 30 years to sort of think, actually, I really ought to sort of get to grips with myself a bit, doesn't it? You sort of keep on, we kind of keep on in this life with dragging all of our past and all of this genetic inheritance with us, often without ever stopping and finding out what it is, trying to understand ourselves, and so on. You know? So there we are in this sort of life we've been given. And basically the Buddha is effectively saying to us, what are you going to do with it? What are you going to do with it? Here you go, you got it, this life of yours. And it goes really, really quickly. The first sutra translated, they think, into English is a sutra of 42 sections. And there's a discussion in that sutra about mortality. We just had a talk on death. And one of the Buddha's disciples says, you know, life feels so short, just feels like a few days. You know, like a weekend break, a city break, in our case. They didn't say that in those days, but you do. Just like a weekend. And then this other novice says, no, actually, it's more like a meal, just like one meal. That's all it is, it goes that quickly. And then the Buddha says, you've not understood. Life takes the time of a single breath. So that's his perspective on life, is it's that quick, it's a single breath. Yeah. It goes so quickly, as you get older it goes even faster. You remember what it was like a weekend when you were a child. A weekend now, this weekend, goes before you even realise it's a weekend. So the Buddha is also saying, what are you going to do about that? There's a life you didn't plan. There's a personhood that you don't actually even know yet. You don't even know yourself. You're in receipt of all sorts of things you didn't ask for. Temperamental things, extroversion, introversion, pessimism, optimism, which you didn't ask for. And then on top of that, this life of yours goes so quickly. And from your point of view, it's the only life you know. And your whole life, your whole experience, it is seen from the point of view of your life. But it goes really, really quickly. I mean, sometimes even when you've been really feeling absorbed in life, it still feels like a dream, doesn't it? Sometimes when I'm on retreat, and when I've had a really good day on retreat, I go to bed at night, and you sort of think, did I experience anything? Is it just a dream? You know, if you think about yesterday, did you experience that? Was it a day, or just were there just stories in our mind and images, and sort of there's a strange dreamlike nature to life, isn't there? A strange unreality almost to it. So there you go. The Buddha would be saying, "What are you going to do about that?" So all this, for me, comes to mean is that our human life is a spiritual issue. Whether you like it or not, whether I like it or not, it's a spiritual issue, because you don't, all those things I've already said, you don't know what it is, you don't know whether, you didn't ask for it, it's not the things you planned, it's not the life you would have designed, and it's going to go really, really quickly. It's going to go, it'll be gone before you know it. To make matters worse, you don't even know when it's going to go. You know, that just sharpens it a bit more. If there is a God, he's got a particularly nasty sense of humour. You know, so not only are you definitely going to die, but you've no idea when. So that casts this incredible sort of shadow over life. So what are you going to do about that? Yeah. And in a certain sense, the whole of Buddhism is, as it were, the Buddha saying, what are you going to do about that? What are you going to do about that? So there's this life. You know that time when you're waiting for a tube and you're getting really, really irritated and it's late and you start looking up and down the platform and totally, oh, God, you know, and cursing London Transport. The Buddha was saying, is this a good idea, given you've got this life that's going to go really, really quickly? And you know, don't you, if the Buddha was standing there, he is, in his rag robe, saying, but you know doing that doesn't make the slightest bit of difference, don't you? You know you're just making yourself unhappy just now, don't you? You know, and that's a shame, because you've just got this life, it's going to be gone really quickly, and this part of it, you're making yourself unhappy. There's nobody making you unhappy, you're just doing it yourself, just for no reason. You're standing there thinking, what should I do? I'll make myself unhappy. Here I do it by wishing something would arrive, but I have no control over it. Oh, come on, arrive. You know, the Buddha, in a certain sense, you don't need the Buddha, do you? It's just obvious. Is that a useful thing to be doing with your life, given that it's going to end? Yeah. So, of course, every epoch, every culture says, that's quite right, and here's what you do with your life. I think what this current climate does, what our modern world does, and it changes, doesn't it, through history, it's depending on all kinds of cultural, historical, political factors. You could say that our current set time says, the thing you need to do with your life, that yes, you're right, it's short, etc., etc., is be a success and have love. And be a success could be big, a success with love, and it can mean success will bring you love. It feels like that's what the world has to offer you. Either success or love. There's a very striking moment in Wagner's The Ring Cycle, this tetralogy of operas, where this god, Wotan, he sings this wonderful monologue, and he says, I ranged about the world, when I was young, I ranged around the world trying to find love. And then when that wouldn't work, I wanted success, I wanted power. I thought that was very, very striking. A very clear sense of what life can offer you. You've either got love or power stroke success. You see what I mean? And usually people start with the first and try and move on to the second. And one of the reasons why people are attracted to power, success and so forth is because you think it's more likely to get you love. It gives you a certain glamour, doesn't it? Yes, it gives you a sort of glamour. So those are the things that I think can, you know, arguably this world offers us, is say, okay, well, you can either be a success and you can get love. So a lot of our life is spent either chasing success or chasing love. Hi there, come in. Well, it's completely natural to want those things, but they just don't work, or they don't work in the way that we want them to work. Success, you get the problem of less and less return from success, don't you? The success tends to work at first, in the first one or two times, but then after that you have to keep upping the ante to get the same feeling of success, don't you? So one of the things I do in my spare time is write poems. And the first, what I once was highly commended in this poetry competition. So I won £15. So, you know, the drinks are on me. And I went up to York to read this poem. I actually spent more on the train fare than I actually won the prize. I was 18 lines long, I remember. I got there, I was so excited. I mean, this was unbelievable. I got there, I read this poem. I mean, you know, that was it, that's all I did, and came back home on the train again. I was so excited. I just loved it. You know, I had this fantastic kind of day, this big day trip. I went to the Minster, but I couldn't afford to go in because I'd spent the money on the train. It was great. Since then, I've had bigger prizes, and the experience of pleasure has dropped with each time. And what you end up with is not pleasure, but just a grim sense of entitlement. By the end, you feel, yes, of course, I should win a prize because I'm very good. You don't have any pleasure from it. I did actually win a small competition recently. I just thought, of course I should. Next. I thought, oh dear, I've already got there. So what you do, you see, you have to win bigger prizes. So American poet Robert Frost, he ended up winning the Pulitzer Prize, which is the biggest prize you can possibly win, pretty much, four times, it's incredible. And he still wasn't happy. By the end of his life, he said, I don't care what people think of my poems as long as they give me prizes. And that's completely natural. But you end up with that problem. The more success you have, the less it affects you, the law of diminishing returns, don't you? In any sphere, whether it's in your work, you know, you get to be promoted, you get a wee buzz, and then guess what? It's bags more work. And then you start to hate that, and then you get promoted again, wee bag, guess what? It's more work. And so you go on. You get diminishing returns, often more and more work. You get sort of kudos, but hey, your life is being often ruined by success. Success, I think, is spiritually very dangerous, humanly very dangerous, much more dangerous than failure. Failure is actually quite good for you. So you go home and tell your friends that failure is quite good for you. But of course, the other main thing we want is we want love. And I sometimes think this is probably the deepest thing, I think, for human beings. I think there's been a secret history of love. There's an unwritten history of love, isn't there? I think it's probably had a much greater role to play in political, social, cultural, artistic life than there's any record of. I mean, the famous case is Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn, but which, after all the reconsiderations of history, people have ended up thinking, actually, no, it was just, he fell for this woman and that's what changed the world. You know, that's what it's ended up as. There was a period in the study of history where people say, oh yes, it's much more complicated than that, but it looks like historians are actually saying, actually, it's not that much more complicated than that. He's just like, very whatever, you know the word, begins with H, and he fell in love with this woman, and then that changed the whole of England, you know. And there's probably issues of that all the way through all of history. Love, sex, the love-sex issue is one of the big motivating issues in human life. It's probably one of the biggest, if not the biggest. My own teacher, Sankaracharya, said if there's an X factor, it's the sex factor. In other words, if there's something about someone that's a bit odd that you can't quite work out, it's often to do with sex. So sex and love are probably one of, if not the biggest issue in our life. For some it's sex and love, and for some others it's love and sex, depending on where you want to put the emphasis. Traditionally, it's men have been sex and love, and women have been love and sex. And that's why one of the reasons men and women easily misunderstand each other, because they can't understand why the emphasis is placed where it is. Yeah. That's probably changing now, but that's been traditionally the case. So, you know, we all want love. I certainly want as much of it as possible, which is why I get to do talks in front of lots of people, because you hope that by multiplying attention you end up with love. You know, I think that's one of the reasons why people get into acting, things like that. You know, you feel, you can't help feeling, if you have lots of people looking at you, you'll end up with love, which of course you don't get. You don't ever get that. But that's what you can fall into if you're not connected. So all of human beings want love. And of course the most obvious place for that is in the romantic sexual arena. Actually, it's only a small part of love, but it's the part that we're obsessed with. It's sort of a room in the house of love, but there's a whole house apart from this, even a mansion apart from this. But particularly in modern life, for modern, highly sophisticated Westerners, whatever Westerners means now, in the developed, so-called developed world, developed in what sense? In the developed world, love and sex have replaced God, effectively. We got rid of God, and we needed something to worship. So we've worshipped love and sex, really. And we've worshipped success, haven't we? So we have a celebrity culture on one hand and a gossip column on another. In a way, those are our twin gods now, is success and love. But love, romantic love, doesn't work from a Buddhist point of view. At least it doesn't work in the sense that we want it to work. It gives us a measure of pleasure and fulfillment and happiness. But it never gives us the pleasure and fulfillment and happiness that we want from it. We want it to make everything all right. And we're told that it can make everything all right. We are effectively, I think, sorry to be so grim, but I think we are ongoingly and continually sold a lie about love, that it really can make everything all right. That all the issues of your life, this spiritual issue of the life you've got, which is a life that's going to end, which is a life that you didn't ask for, that you didn't design, that has got suffering in it whether you want it or not, that's got the sort of suffering that you have, which is different from the suffering that other people have. We hope, we have this incredible wish to believe that love will be the answer. But what we've ended up meaning by that is that romantic love, particularly in the developed world, will be the answer. And what that's doing, and what that has done, is create lots and lots of pain. Because if you try to get something out of something that it can't give, you're going to get pain from it. If you're going into romantic relationships to get some degree of companionship, to get sex, to get pleasure, to some degree, to at least a degree of pleasure, then fine, you know. But if you're going into it to save your life, to be the God of your life, the centre of your life, the illuminating principle of your life, then it's not going to work. And you're going to end up either feeling, I can't do it, other people can do this love thing, but I can't, or this person I'm with isn't right, so I need to move on to another person, or I need to have more than one lover, and so on. It is one of the deepest difficulties. I mean, the Buddha, when he left home, famously went forth. He left the palace that he was living in. Interestingly, before he was enlightened, the Buddha is a title, so it means the awake. He basically, as a young man before he was a Buddha, he was just a young, very healthy, seemingly from the sutras, a very healthy young man. He was very sporting, kind of athletic. Your sense of the Buddha is someone who's very energetic and athletic. I was saying on a recent retreat that it would be better if Buddhism is associated with things like extreme sports, because that is more like the pre-enlightened Buddha. It's become associated with crystal healing and muesli, hasn't it? one feels obliged to eat muesli for Buddhist reasons. And, you know, I'm nothing wrong with muesli. I had some this morning. I always have muesli. Maybe crystals, but it would be better if it was associated with things like rock climbing and extreme sport. That's what the pre-enlightened Buddha was like. He was very deeply thinking, but very active. And interestingly, he'd known sex and love. So traditionally he was married. Actually, nobody really knows, because in the earliest sculptures that tell the story, there's no image of his wife or his child. But traditionally, he had a wife and child, a young son and a beautiful wife. And he left them in the middle of the night. He left them to go and search for the truth. And the reason he left them was not because he was irresponsible father and so on. It was because he'd seen that birth meant that you would get old, you would get sick, and one day you would die. And that, to him, seemed an ineluctable problem. The great problem of life was that you would grow old, you would get sick, and you would die. And you definitely didn't want to do that. So what was the solution to that? That's what the Buddha left home to find, is the solution to his life, and the solution, as it were, to our life. He's just like us, in the sense that he's got this life that's been given to him, that's got these three things written into it, even though he hasn't put them there. They've got sickness, they've got old age, they've got suffering. So when he picks his son up into his arms, he knows, yes, but he's going to get sick and old and suffer. Recently I had a family reunion. I come from Warwickshire, and I have a very large family, and we had four generations on one couch. I don't know how many, about 18 or 20 of us, all crowded onto one couch. My poor mother, you know, 76, sort of wobbling in the middle. But then, you know, from my mother, who's 76, to my most recent niece, who's 10 days old. In fact, my family will become epidemic if we're not careful. We'll have to be cold, isn't it? And I found it very, very poignant, because the niece who's just had her daughter, a lovely little daughter, I remember her at that age. And I remember, you know, a very poignant sort of sense of just the wheel turning round again and again. Birth, old age, sickness and death, birth, old age, sickness and death. An inescapable round. And that's what the Buddha thought, not thought, but that's what the Buddha saw as being the problem of human life. And he left home to solve it. But he did leave home. He didn't think, tell you what, I can work it out here with my YouTube and Xbox. He had to leave home. So that saying that a Buddhist spiritual life has always a degree of leaving home, of going forth. And leaving home is leaving home from, like, it's interesting that the palace is also an image for our habitual mind. It's interesting that in the story, he leaves the palace and sees an old man. Literally, he goes out to the palace and sees an old man. Metaphorically, I think that's saying he leaves his usual mindset. He leaves his habitual way of seeing things, his conventional upbringing. He leaves all that behind just for a moment, and he sees in that moment, oh my God, I'm going to get old. And then he goes back to the palace again, goes back into his conventional habitual mindset. So going forth is always leaving behind, even a little bit, our underlying basic mindset, the kind of person we are, the kind of habit of being me, and seeing life more deeply. But, you know, he leaves his wife and his son. So this is saying somewhere, somehow, that any genuine spiritual life needs a degree of non-attachment to romantic love, really. Now, how you work that out in your life, in my life, there's lots of ways to start to work that out. The modern vision is monogamy is best. I think monogamy is wildly overrated, actually. Not that I get a chance at anything else, but anyway. It's become morally sort of good. And it can be, but it can be awfully painful, can't it? I've known monogamous relationships where all they ever do is argue. And you just think, actually, it'd be better to split up or have a few others, you know, you can enjoy yourself with. If that's what's good about monogamy, I can't see why that's so good, you know. So there's lots of different ways of working out. In Buddhism, you end up with the Buddha was celibate, and the Buddha always encouraged that. Hugely difficult in modern life. I'm not celibate, and in fact, I think that if I'm not careful, celibacy will be thrust upon me rather than me actually move towards it. But we need to find some way of not putting all our eggs into the romantic basket, which is what modern life is telling us to do all the time. Just be a success and get love, and then you'll be fine. And it just won't work. If anybody has made it work, do come and see me afterwards, because I'd quite like to believe it did, or that it could. But it just won't work, and it causes pain. It makes you think that you've got it wrong. I think we're selling a lie, which is causing millions and millions of people unnecessary suffering. So what Buddhism, I think what the Buddha would be saying to us, is how can you live a fuller life that's not just the conventional mind in your palace with your wife and your kid and your dog and your goldfish and your YouTube and your Xbox and your mobile phone and your iPod, you know. How can you get beyond that restricted sphere? In the parable of the Buddha's life, it's like a walled castle that he's almost locked inside. So you have to start to free yourself. Partly that is freeing oneself from an addiction to sex or from particularly neurotically dependent sexual relationships where your whole happiness is bound up with your feelings about your partner. My own teacher, Sangharakshita, and I'll finish with this, says that the test of whether you're dependent on your sexual partner is what happens when they leave you. So when they leave you, if you think, that's great, that's fine, it's been great, it's been nice to see you, good luck, then you can say to them, well, I've not been that dependent. Actually, I've known people do that, and then the next day, suddenly wail for about a week. Because you get this moment of relief, don't you? You've had that when you split up with someone. You get a kind of moment of freedom. Oh, yeah, there's this great cut. I'm really quite mature. And then the next morning you wake up and you've done something. Why is everything so dark? And really, why is there no meaning in the world? So you do have that moment sometimes. So in a way, that's the sharp end for us. How can we not end up addicted to sex? And I think sexual addiction is becoming a real issue, particularly things like pornography. I mean, pornography is a massive issue that isn't getting talked about enough, at least talked about sensibly enough. It easily gets moralised so you can't have the discussion, but it's a huge issue, particularly for men, very often a secret one. So how do we not get addicted to pornography, or how do we not just get addicted to the romantic couple, either the one we're in, or the endless searching for one, even when you're in one, sort of keeping a half an eye lookout for a better bargain. So in a way, lots of Buddhist practices are about trying to find a way out of that. Classic Buddhist way out of that is cultivating the love that you're looking for in yourself in meditation. At best, meditation is making love inside yourself all the time. I mean, that is a selling meditation. That's what meditation at its best is like. It's like the pleasure of sex and love, but it's happening inside yourself without clinging, if you see what I mean. It's a pleasure you're yearning for, but it's experienced inside you as a rapturous inner sense, not as a outward sense. And then you've got things like the cultivation of a much deeper and much fuller friendships. And again, modern life has sort of incredibly thinned human friendships, so that friendships are what happen when you haven't got a relationship often. They happen through the chinks in time between relationships. You end up, suddenly your friends suddenly ring you up again, and then they meet somebody and guess what, they don't ring you anymore, you know. So that's what I'm saying. So what I started with, the problem of our life. We've got our life. That's our real problem, and I think it's a spiritual problem. I don't think it is, I think it just obviously is, because life has got suffering, old age and death written into it, and you never wanted that. And you never planned for this life, and you didn't plan for the particular suffering that you've been given. You didn't plan for the genetic loading you've been given. And it's going to end soon. So what are you going to do with that life? The usual answer is, tell you what, be a success, be a pop star, or you know, a CEO, find the partner, your love object, find the couple of your life, the romantic relationship of your life. That's the answer we're giving people, and it's causing lots of pain. So what Buddhism would say is, okay, we need another way out of this problem. Okay, let's leave it there for a minute, and then we'll do some questions. A hand went straight up. Yes.
Thanks, Michael Dundee. A life we didn't ask for and a strength we didn't plan. Yeah. Are you familiar with the name Joanna Macy and what kind of Buddhist she is? She takes
I've never read Macy's work, but I am familiar with her, yeah.
She led me on a guided meditation once, suggesting to all the people in the room at Findhorn, which was the only kind of place you could probably do it, because it was so left field for the way I've seen meditation sound before. She said, imagine you're floating in space. You get a choice.
We need to move through to the question, but yeah.
Okay. So, can you short circuit the whole of this issue by fundamentally questioning your opening assumption, which is that if you are led in meditation to choose your family, as I did, it suddenly led to a massive sense of contentment. Yes, they're challenging my family, but I chose them. Somewhere from outer space.
Yeah. Well, let me answer that in a slightly different way.
I chose them, I'm content with that.
Let me answer that. The Tibetan tradition is that you do actually choose your parents. Now, I think we have to be very careful with these traditions because they're pre-modern traditions, and they're talking in a highly metaphorical way, which ends up getting literalised, as if you literally are up there on a cloud somewhere thinking, not him, he's nice, she's really nice, how about those two? I don't think it can possibly be like that, because life's not like that, and I bet you that death isn't like that. I think it's getting at something, though. I think it's saying that the life you've got somehow suits you, somehow is the right kind of context for you. This comes out of a Buddhist belief in rebirth, not reincarnation. So it's, and that's too far to go into. But I think there's something suggestive about that this life you've got somehow is that you've chosen it. Now, what I get from that, and I want to be highly metaphorical because we're now talking about deep human and spiritual issues which are never technical and literal. But there's a sense, isn't there, sometimes, when even the terrible things of people's lives sometimes become their genius. So, for instance, just to take myself as a sort of very... I haven't had anything terrible in my life at all. I've been very, very fortunate. But I was brought in a small town. I'm gay. Just to... everyone screams. No. Everyone's saying, good heavens, something I would never have thought. Of all things, you know. Anyway, so... I was brought up in this small town where, in my mind, that was just... it was an awful thing. I used to pray to God when I was a child, but that wasn't true. I remember fantasising that perhaps I'd have an accident, I'd get crippled or something, so that I wouldn't be able to have a sex life, therefore no one would need to know. You know, this was as a five-year-old, or a six-year-old. I would pray, literally pray, which is disgraceful. It's just like being born with brown eyes. It's nothing to chat right home about, and it's nothing to get worried about. You know what I mean? It's just like having curly hair. But there I was, praying that I didn't have curly hair. Which I did, and even everyone around me seemed to see that I can have curly hair. But I've come to think that it was, in that time, I don't think it would have been like that now, but it's also become the genius of my life. Because it meant that I never felt at home in my small town of Henley Norden. I couldn't go on to the family business like my brothers did. I didn't believe this life I was being given, which was grow up, go to work, get married, have a family, get a retirement plan, and die. That was what was being given to me, and I just thought that can't be right. And something of that being gay was part of that. You see what I mean? It was but I don't fit. And I thought for me that's become one of the values of my life. Not being gay. I don't think it is a value. I think it's just like having freckles or something, but because it was part of creating a sense I don't fit in this life. That was then something that I think led me to Buddhism. So in a strange way, and I've known people with much worse. I mean that actually wasn't that so bad, but I've known people with really quite terrible starts to life that they've made the genius of your life. In fact, I think that's the only way with things like that. You somehow have to make it the genius of your life. It's not something you can ever deal with in a certain sense. Anyway, there's much more to say that, but I'll leave it at that just now. Yeah. Anyone's on love?
You're talking about spiritual path would mean not being attached to romantic love. So if you do find yourself falling in love with somebody, how do you not get lost in that or lose yourself in that whole thing and become a couple, like a Brangelina, whatever, entity fused together? How do you not lose yourself as you start to fall in love?
I'm not sure you can at first. I haven't fallen in love with donkeys yet, but that first bit is wonderful, isn't it? And that what that first part of falling in love, I think, is... It's lovely to feel someone in love with you, for instance. It makes you feel very... Oh, that's nice. It makes you feel so comfortable. So I think at first there's this lovely kind of arc of love. And I think what that's doing... It's a bit like LSD, I think. You know, LSD doesn't do anything. It just opens certain neural pathways, or really. Anyway, when I took it, a long time ago, folks, don't worry. don't report me. I just had this incredible opening up. You know, I was in Cornwall, I took this LSD... Suddenly the world was wondrous, absolutely wondrous. I don't think it's a path, because of course when it stopped working it just closed. But it did show me, look, there's much more to you than you think. You've got this wondrous world, if only you can find a way into it. I think that first falling in love is a bit analogous to that. All that love, the explosion of images, the radiance that goes with it. You see how you see them so lit up. And sometimes your own eyes light up and your life becomes can become for a moment sort of blessed. That's saying, what you see, that's there in your consciousness. Because of course what happens is gradually that dies away again. I remember, I know that Auden, for instance, thought that that falling in love state was actually our natural state, and then we kept on losing it. And we lose it by attaching it to somebody else, by thinking it belongs to them, and then worrying about that. But actually, like Alice is telling us, that's what our mind is capable of, this lit world. It's a kind of secular, sacred, really, love. But then so often it then goes on into being... well, Freud called it the psychosis of ordinary people. It's a sort of madness at times. And then after that psychosis of ordinary people, it very often just ends up being the dying dead, doesn't it? I think it's from a film, wasn't it, called The Last Sunshine of the Modern Mind? Yeah, and he talked about the dying dead in it, which I thought was a terrifying but accurate image for old couples. All you've got left is attachment. You don't know whether you like each other, you just react off each other. You've just got attachment, but you can't live with each other and you can't live without each other. So I think mainly in that process we need to allow love to arise. You want actually more of that. You want to be finding it in your experience more. One psychologist says pay attention to the explosion of images. All of that. Enjoy that. Realise that it's yours. And try and keep a clear head about what's actually happening here. But enjoy, you know, the great unfolding. And then make sure, as you go along, that you don't just keep putting all your eggs into it. I think one of the great dangers of love, it just makes you more and more conventional very easily. You end up with those olive oil bottles with little twigs in. that's my end point of conventionality. Used to be a caravan and a dog. Now it's those olive oil things with little twiggy things in. And you look at them and think, oh, that'd be nice. Twiggy things in. And then when you've got to there, you have to think, tell you what, I've lost the plot. I'm going to die, for heaven's sake. And I just bought some olive oil with little twiggy things in. So I think that's one of the dangers. You just drift without meaning to, and because of the pressure of the society around you, which is so predicated on it. You just drift into being highly conventional and frankly boring, middle-aged, muddled and all that sort of thing, with olive oil in it. So I think friendship, you know, keep practicing the spiritual life, keep meditating, keep developing friendship, keep trying to live in a separate life. It's very striking. I've seen some couples that, you know, they look like they've been Velcro together. And it's quite obviously, you think, would you ever get a grip? It's like drunken people, I think. But yeah, I know some couples who have very good relationship with each other and have a quite clear separate life. They're living their own lives, and they meet, and you know, I think that's much healthier. And I think you're much more likely to have healthier relationships if you've got a very strong basis of healthy friendships, so that you're not looking for everything from your lover. You know, you want them to listen to you, you want them to fix a car, you want them to be a master chef, you want them to, you know, talk about Einstein, you know. This modern model we've created is really quite mad. Yeah. Another question at the back, and then there's two more questions.
Well, I think you touched on it in the last thing you said.
Right, yeah.
I was going to say that often romantic love can blossom into love, and some people are together for many, many years, and they wouldn't have it any other way.
No.
It doesn't feel quite like you described it always. You know, it's not always like that. Often it can be the most valuable thing that can happen to a person.
That's true for some. I'm not sure about often, but for some. I think from the Buddhist perspective, even that most valuable thing isn't actually very much compared to what life can offer, if you know what I mean. So it depends what perspective we're taking on it. But yeah, for instance, my parents had a very stable, very good relationship. But so often one feels one has that, and suddenly they go off with somebody else, and you realise you hardly knew them at all. I know that story so much, where you thought you had that, and then something happens, you think, oh, I didn't really know you at all. I actually think that's more common. But yes, I take your point.
That's quite natural. maybe that's like a story that we sort of sell ourselves anyway, that we think we know people.
And we don't. Actually, it's much more difficult to know people than we think. Saint Gratian, our founder of this movement, has emphasised that again and again, how difficult it is to know someone. And we easily think we know them long before we do. And especially family and lovers, it's much more difficult to know. Because you want something off them. I mean, family, it's very, very difficult to know your family, for instance. You know how you respond to them, you know their habits, but you don't really know them.
Because you were saying before, yeah, maybe it's the biggest, I don't know, whatever, I've forgotten. But
yeah.
Maybe that's an even bigger thing, stuff that we think we know.
Right, yeah.
Because
yeah.
You can get wrapped up in your, I don't know,
yeah.
I'm just sort of thinking myself, feeling can think we know stuff.
Yes, that's
it's
right.
Love or it's this yeah. Or it's that. And it's, like you were saying before, maybe it's like, is it a dream?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think we need to work much more at realising that we don't know.
Mm.
I think that would be a much, much better place. We know so much, we know nothing. I mean, I was thinking of looking at a blackbird one day and thinking, I don't even know much about them. You know, how long do they live? I've no idea. And, you know, what do they do with their time? You know what I mean? So that's just a blackbird in my garden. Most of life I don't know much about. And... But yeah, I take your point. There's two more questions and let's finish with those. Let's go for you.
I was just wondering if you think it's necessary to be single and celibate to achieve like enlightenment or progress in spiritual life, or if it's possible to do that in the context of a relationship and a family. Because it seems there's different teachings on the subject.
There is, yeah, yeah. I mean, I always wanted to just go back to the Buddha. He clearly, he was quite scandalous at the time because he clearly was encouraging people to leave home. He would have been seen as a menace by some people, and if he was alive now, he'd be seen as a real menace because he'd be trying to undermine society. He'd be saying, this is rubbish. I mean, he'd be much more outspoken than me, I think, because he would just say, well, what are you doing that for? You know, you just go, just leave, just stop it. Be terrifying. I mean, we want to make the Buddha into this lovely. Sweet guy, he just sort of smiles a lot. And like, but he'd just say, what are you doing that for? You know, he wouldn't say it unpleasantly, but I'll come back to you in a second.
I just wanted to make an interjection. But you're just saying it from the man's point of view. If everybody left, then they'd have a big community.
Yes, indeed, yeah. Let me carry on. I know where you're going. That was only the start. So he definitely suggested people to leave home, and he also had disciples who didn't. And some of those disciples were renowned to have gained insight, you know, basically what the goal of, sort of goal, very inverted commas, of spiritual life, who had families and, you know, so and so forth. So if that was the case, that must still be the case. You've got different kinds of lifestyle. And it's a difficult issue for anyone to choose between those lifestyles. But clearly the Buddha had enlightened lay disciples, some of them quite remarkable in their own right. So again, I want to look at the principle from the Buddha's life and experience, and if I think he encouraged people to leave home, but he wouldn't then say, well, if you can't, don't bother with that. He'd say, well, here's the practice then, and some of those people who did that practice made remarkable progress under much more difficult conditions than we're in, with many more children than we have. In a world much less amenable, in some ways, actually, our conditions are more difficult. That's another story. But.
I was going to talk about the kind of hierarchy of relationships that there appears to be in society, with romantic at the top.
Yes. Yeah.
And first of all, kind of thinking about how do we develop deeper love for our friends, and then secondly, how do we sort of deal with the pain that might not be reciprocated when someone romantic comes along for us.
Yeah. Say the second part again.
So, if we develop kind of deeper loving relationships with our friends, when somebody romantic comes along for them, it may start to not be reciprocated, or we sometimes get left inside.
Yeah,
so,
that's right,
how do we deal with that?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's very painful. I mean, I've had that so many times. It is very painful. You know, you're developing friendship with someone, and they get off with someone, and suddenly, even when you see them, they're sort of emotionally not there. They don't sort of need friends anymore, or they think they don't. So they're sort of emotionally not quite there. They're not really relating to you. They're kind of waiting for a text message from their boyfriend or girlfriend. You know. I think not everybody does that, but it's quite a strong tendency, isn't it? And I think the Buddhist answer would be to forgive him, because we could do it. I mean, we all fall for love. I mean, all of us. You know what I mean? Well, it's one of the things that can so easily happen to anyone at any age. Just when you think, no, no, I'm clear on that, you meet somebody on the bus and Bob's your uncle, you know what I mean? I'm trying to think of a female name, not Bob, but anyway. Somebody else is your auntie, as it were. I'm struck in, for instance, in Shakespeare, the figure of Malvolio, it's in the 12th night, isn't it? And he's conned into believing that this very beautiful young woman is actually in love with him. And it's very striking to play, because people's retaliation to him is vicious. It's supposed to be a comedy, it's not funny at all, it's really horrible by the end. And he makes such a fool of himself. He makes the work, you know, it's like a parody of making a fool of himself. He's an old fool. But I think that's a brilliant warning to us all. You know, don't think that you've... If you're not careful, we get very moral and indignant about our friend going off with somebody. But actually, next day we're doing it. So I think there needs to be forgiveness. The question of how to deepen friendship, I think, is mainly a question of time. Time, giving to friendship. And then not being stuck at the social level. So many of our so-called friendships are just stuck at a social level. So we never get to say, what is that? What did happen to you just then? You know, you say that, I never quite know what you mean. We never take it, if you're not careful, to the next level. We just get stuck at, what film did you see? That's really got out a bit when, you know, which is fine, and I do, frankly, quite a lot of that. But you want a place where you say the unsayable, that you take it to a new level, the sort of thing that you'd usually only do with a couple. The sort of thing, analogous to that, where you say, yeah, but what goes on with you when you get like this? I don't understand it. You know, that question that you're not supposed to ask, when someone says, oh, my boss is really awful, and what you're supposed to not say is, actually, I think you're being a bit difficult in that as well. You're supposed to say, yeah, I'm sure. You're supposed to you know, oh, really? Oh, I can't believe it. You know, and then you often, if you're careful, go to someone else and say, well, actually, I think they've got a part to play in it. So friendship is where you step over those kind of boundaries and insist on going beyond a merely social interaction, valuable though that is, and taking risks. Emotional risk, particularly.
Well, sometimes that may be just that you acknowledge whatever, if you're feeling hurt for that person.
Yeah.
Sometimes maybe.
Sometimes just that.
Yeah.
So we better finish there, I think, because time's moving on. So there we go. That's our little starting to think about love, a few questions about love. Lots more things going on today. Hope to see you a bit later on.